page 51. Chapter 8. The Chorus Line. If I Was a Princess, a popular tune, as performed by the maids, with a fiddle, an accordion, and a penny whistle. First maid. If I was a princess with silver and gold, and loved by a hero, I'd never grow old. Oh, if a young hero came a-marrying me, I'd always be beautiful, happy, and free. Chorus. Then sail, my fine lady, on the billowing wave. The water below is as dark as the grave. And maybe you'll sink in your little blue boat. It's hope and hope only that keeps us afloat. Page 52. Second maid. I fetch and I carry, I hear and obey. It's yes, sir, and no, ma'am, the whole bleeding day. I smile and I nod with a tear in my eye. I make the soft beds in which others do lie. Third maid. O gods and O prophets, please alter my life, and let a young hero take me for his wife. But no hero comes to me early or late. Hard work is my destiny, death is my fate. Chorus. Then sail, my fine lady, on the billowing wave. The water below is as dark as the grave. And maybe you'll sink in your little blue boat. It's hope and hope only that keeps us afloat. Page 53. The maids all curtsy. Melantho of the pretty cheeks, passing the hat. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Page 54 is blank. Page 55. Chapter 9. The Trusted Cackle Hen. The sea voyage to Ithaca was long and frightening, and also nauseating, or at least I found it so. I spent most of the time lying down or throwing up, sometimes both at once. Possibly I had an aversion to the ocean due to my childhood experience, or possibly the sea god Poseidon was still annoyed by his failure to devour me. Thus I saw little of the beauties of sky and cloud that Odysseus reported on his rare visits to see how I was feeling. He spent most of the time either at the bow, peering ahead, I imagined, with a hawk-like gaze in order to spot rocks and sea serpents and other dangers, or at the tiller, or directing the ship in some other way, I didn't know how, because I'd never been on a ship before in my life. I'd gained a great opinion of Odysseus since our wedding day, and admired him immensely, and had an inflated notion of his capabilities. Remember, I was 15, so I had the highest confidence in him, and considered him to be a sea captain who could not fail. Page 56. At last we arrived at Ithaca, and sailed into the harbor, which was surrounded by steep, rocky cliffs. They must have posted lookouts and lit beacons to announce our approach, because the harbor was thronged with people. A certain amount of cheering went on, and a lot of jostling among those who wanted to see what I looked like as I was led ashore. Visible proof of the fact that Odysseus had succeeded in his mission, and had brought back a noble bride and the valuable gifts that came with her. That night there was a feast for the aristocrats of the town. I appeared at it, wearing a shining veil and one of the best embroidered robes I had brought with me, and accompanied by the maid I had also brought. She was a wedding present to me from my father. Her name was Actoris, and she was not at all happy to be there in Ithaca with me. She hadn't wanted to leave the luxuries of the Spartan palace and her friends among the servants, and I didn't blame her. Page 57. As she was not at all young, even my father would not have been so stupid as to send a blooming girl with me, a possible rival for Odysseus's affections, especially since one of her tasks was to stand sentinel every night outside our bedroom door to prevent interruptions. She did not last long. Her death left me all alone in Ithaca, a stranger among strange people. I did a lot of secluded weeping in those early days. I tried to conceal my unhappiness from Odysseus, as I did not wish to appear unappreciative, and he himself continued to be as attentive and considerate as he had been at first, Although his manner was that of an older person to a child, I often caught him studying me, head on one side, chin in hand, as if I were a puzzle. But that was his habit with all, I soon discovered. He told me once that everyone had a hidden door, which was the way into the heart, and that it was a point of honor with him to be able to find the handles to those doors. Page 58. For the heart was both key and lock, and he who could master the hearts of men and learn their secrets was well on the way to mastering the fates and controlling the thread of his own destiny. Not, he hastened to add, that any man could really do that. Not even the gods, he said, were more powerful than the three fatal sisters. He did not mention them by name, but spat to avoid bad luck, and I shivered to think of them in their glum cave, spinning out lives, measuring them, cutting them off. Do I have a hidden door into my heart? I asked, in what I hoped was a winsome and flirtatious manner. And have you found it? At this, Odysseus only smiled. That is for you to tell me, he said. And do you have a door into your heart as well? I said. And have I found the key? I blush to recall the simpering tone in which I asked this. It was the kind of wheedling Helen might have done. But Odysseus had turned and was looking out of the window. A ship has entered the harbor, he said. It's not one I know. He was frowning. Page 59. Are you expecting news? I asked. I'm always expecting news, he said. Ithaca was no paradise. It was often windy and frequently rainy and cold. The nobles were a shabby lot compared with those I was used to, and the palace, although sufficient, was not what you would consider large. There were indeed a lot of rocks and goats, as I'd been told back home, but there were cows as well, and sheep, and pigs, and grain to make bread, and sometimes a pear or an apple or a fig in season. So we were well supplied at table, and in time I got more used to the place. Also, to have a husband like Odysseus was no mean thing. Everyone in the region looked up to him, and petitioners and those seeking his advice were numerous. Some even came in ships from far away to consult him, as he had a reputation as a man who could undo any complicated knot, though sometimes by tying a more complicated one. Page 60. His father, Laertes, and his mother, Anticlea, were still in the palace at that time. His mother had not yet died, worn out by watching and waiting for Odysseus to return, and, I suspect, by her own bilious digestive system, and his father had not yet quitted the palace in despair at his son's absence to live in a hovel and penalize himself by farming. All of that would happen once Odysseus had been gone for years, but there was no foreshadowing of it yet. My mother-in-law was circumspect. She was a prune-mouthed woman, and though she gave me a formal welcome, I could tell she didn't approve of me. She kept saying that I was certainly very young. Odysseus remarked dryly that this was a fault that would correct itself in time. The woman who gave me the most trouble at first was Odysseus's former nurse, Eurycleia. She was widely respected, according to her, because she was so intensely reliable. She'd been in the household ever since Odysseus's father had bought her, and so highly that he valued her that he didn't even sleep with her. Imagine that for a slave woman, she clucked to me, delighted with herself. Page 61. And I was a very good-looking in those days. Some of the maids told me that Laertes had refrained, not out of respect for Eurycleia, but from fear of his wife, who would never have given him any peace if he'd taken a concubine. That Anticlea would freeze the balls off Helios, as one of them put it. I knew I should have reprimanded her for her impudence, but I couldn't repress my laughter. Eurycleia made a point of taking me under her wing, leading me about the palace to show me where everything was, and as she kept saying, how we do things here, I ought to have thanked her for it with my heart as well as my lips, for there is nothing more embarrassing than to make a slip of manners, thus displaying your ignorance of the customs of those around you. Whether to cover the mouth when you laugh, on what occasions to wear a veil, how much of the face it should conceal, how often to order a bath, Euryclea was an expert on all such manners. All such matters. That was lucky, for my mother-in-law, Anticlea, who ought to have taken charge in this way, was content to sit silently and say nothing, while I made a fool of myself, a tight little smile on her face. Page 62. She was happy that her adored son Odysseus had pulled off such a coup. A princess of Sparta was not to be sneezed at, but I think she would have been better pleased if I'd died of seasickness on the way to Ithaca, and Odysseus had arrived home with the bridal presents, but not the bride. Her most frequent expression to me was, "You don't look well." So I avoided her when I could, and I went around with Euryclea, who was at least friendly. She had a fund of information about all the neighboring noble families, and in that way I learned a great many discreditable things about them that would be useful to me later on. She talked all the time, and nobody was the world's expert on Odysseus the way she was. She was full of information about what he liked and how he had to be treated, for hadn't she nursed him at her own breast and tended him when he was an infant and brought him up as a youth? Nobody but she must give him his baths, oil his shoulders, prepare his breakfasts, lock up his valuables, lay out his robes for him, and so on and so forth. Page 63. She left me with nothing to do. No little office I might perform for my husband, for if I tried to carry out any small wifely task, she would be right there to tell me that wasn't how Odysseus liked things done. Even the robes I made for him were not quite right, too light, too heavy, too sturdy, too flimsy. "It will do well enough for the steward," she would say, "but surely not for Odysseus." Nonetheless, she tried to be kind to me in her own way. "We'll have to fatten you up," she would say, "so you can have a nice big son for Odysseus. That's your job. You just leave everything else to me." As she was the nearest thing there was to someone I could talk to, besides Odysseus, that is, I came to accept her in time. She did make herself invaluable when Telemachus was born. I am honor-bound to record that. She said the prayers to Artemis when I was in too much pain to speak, and she held my hands and sponged off my forehead and caught the baby and washed him and wrapped him up warmly, for if there was one thing she knew, as she kept telling me, it was babies. Page 64. She had a special language for them, a nonsense language. "Uzi woo," she would croon to Telemachus when drying him after his bath, "a google woogle poo," and it unsettled me to think of my barrel-chested and deep-voiced Odysseus, so skilled in persuasion, so articulate, so dignified, as an infant lying in her arms and having this gurgling discourse addressed to him. But I couldn't begrudge her the care she took of Telemachus. Her delight in him was boundless. You'd almost have thought she'd given birth to him herself. Odysseus was pleased with me. Of course he was. "Helen hasn't borne a son yet," he said, which ought to have made me glad, and it did. But on the other hand, why was he still, and possibly always, thinking about Helen? Page 65. Chapter 10. The Chorus Line. The Birth of Telemachus, an Idol. 9 months he sailed the wine-red seas of his mother's blood, out of the cave of dreaded night, of sleep, of troubling dreams he sailed in his frail dark boat, the boat of himself. Through the dangerous ocean of his vast mother he sailed, from the distant cave where the threads of men's lives are spun, then measured and then cut short by the three fatal sisters, intent on their gruesome handcrafts, and the lives of women also are twisted into the strand. Page 66. And we, the 12 who were later to die by his hand, at his father's relentless command, sailed as well in the dark frail boats of ourselves, through the turbulent seas of our swollen and sore-footed mothers, who were not